My name is Sally Steenland, and I direct the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative here at the Center for American Progress. With me today is Reverend Elizabeth Barnum. She's Associate Minister at the Barrington Congregational Church in Barrington, Rhode Island. In addition to working with the senior pastor to help lead worship, Elizabeth facilitates the church's confirmation program, offers pastoral support, oversees youth ministry, and provides ministry team support. She currently serves on the Bradley Hospital Ethics Committee and the Rhode Island Conference Board of Directors for the United Church of Christ. Elizabeth has a background in secondary education, and she has been trained in a sexuality education curriculum called Our Whole Lives. So welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Sally.
Let's get started. We know that church leaders like yourself, clergy, are on the front lines of the communities that you serve, and you see up close the struggles of families and individuals. Can you tell us some of the pressing issues in your congregation and in your community?
Of course. Yes, it does feel like we're on the front lines witnessing many struggles of families and individuals. Families are struggling to keep their jobs, to send their children to college, to find the resources and help needed to either overcome addictions or address mental health issues or the rising healthcare costs. They worry about losing a job, and in fact some do. And this time of year I meet with young couples who are preparing for their weddings, and they're making decisions together about how to manage student debt, how to buy a house, whether or not they will decide to be parents, and when and how.
So,
and in Rhode Island, especially, we have a high unemployment rate. It's of particular concern. And the church that I work at is located on a public transportation bus line. And individuals stop by on quite a regular basis and ask for assistance. Sometimes they need perishables for their children they weren't able to obtain at local food pantries, or diapers or personal hygiene products. And we try to really send them to the places that can help them the best, or to provide some direct aid if we're able to.
So can you talk about all these different kinds of aid? So that's a huge range of needs. And some of that is pastoral care. Some of it's practical care. So when people come to you, what kinds of care do you provide?
I think first and foremost, as a pastor, I see my role is to provide a patient ear and to really listen, but also to do triage in some ways. And as clergy, we tend to know our communities well and are able to send people to resources in other places where they can get the kind of help that they need as well. And members of our congregation work in a variety of fields in the community. Some are teachers, some are contractors, some have served or serve in the military, some are government employees or public officials, and all are trying to find ways to make good decisions for their families and communities, and how to be of service of others. So when we gather on Sunday mornings, people are looking for inspiration and sustenance so they can go out and be contributing citizens.
I have a question that's just a little bit political that I want to ask you.
Sure.
Some conservative political folks and others who believe the federal budget should be cut and that, so they believe that economically, but philosophically also believe that the government should get out of the business of providing social services, because that makes people dependent. And the government is a secular organization, and that really everything from job training to homeless shelters to food kitchens to all of those social service programs should be provided by houses of worship and churches such as yourself. So if that were to happen, could you meet those needs?
Absolutely not. And we can't even meet the needs currently at all. And I have to say to people on a regular basis, there's so much need, and we're just not able to meet every need. And I really believe that for healing and wholeness for individuals and for communities and for the country, that it is a matrix. We need everybody and all realms of the public sphere really working together to make things change and to provide for basic needs. So it's really, to me, a matrix and a big web, and we need everybody.
So you raise an interesting point, because often houses of worship and faith-based organizations are seen as oppositional to the government. You know, it's either one or the other, but you're really talking about partnerships, working together and everybody doing their part.
I really do see it that way. I really do.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to shift a little bit because I know some of your training, your background, and your interest is in both women and youth. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of, again, just going back to the front lines and what you witness, are there particular issues that pop out at you that are specific to women or specific to young people? You mentioned student debt, starting families, and things like that. Is there anything else that you would want to highlight?
Well, absolutely. I think the women, the young girls in the congregation, in the community around here, my peers, my colleagues, are all trying to make the best decisions that they can for their families and communities. And with that comes a whole range of reproductive health issues. And I see day in and day out people discerning how to make wise choices about relationships, about partnership, about marriage, about when to have children, if to have children, how to have them, and how to get the resources and support and education and information that they need.
So you just described a very big bucket of issues that people struggle with and face, and important decisions people have to make around family, around reproduction, around a whole bunch of issues. So let's put that in one bucket. And then on another bucket, there's this term called sexuality education. Are those two the same? Is when you talk about sexuality education, are you talking about the things that are in the first bucket? And can you talk a little bit more about how you see sexuality education?
Absolutely. I really believe that both sexuality and spirituality are blessings and are God-given gifts, and that human beings are both sexual beings and spiritual beings. We are bodies and souls, and sexuality and spirituality inform our experience of relationship, and or in church language, I use the word covenant, our mm-hmm. covenant with one another. And so I see sexuality education and religious education as two sides of the same coin, and quite simply and profoundly, it all comes down to love. That our sexuality is one of the ways that we express love as human beings, and for many people, being a part of a religious community is another way that we express love through worship and through service in the world. And for me, as a person of faith in a Christian tradition, I really understand the stories about Jesus and the teachings of Jesus as stories and teachings that are grounded in love mm-hmm. and in justice. And so for that reason, I think sexuality education and religious education go hand in hand.
When you say that to your parishioners, when you say that to other people, do they kind of blink in surprise, or do people say, yes, of course? Is that a hard sell to say sexuality education and religious education go hand in hand? Do you then have a lot of explaining to do that's kind of a blank slate? People don't understand it, or is there opposition? What are the range of reactions you get?
Right. I have been pleasantly surprised by, I think, the openness and willingness to address some of these issues in the particular congregation that I'm a part of right now. You know, one of the things in sexuality education or in religious education that I believe is that parents are the primary sexuality educators and faith educators of their children, but parents appreciate help. So when I talk with parents about sexuality education and faith education, they're usually grateful. They want their schools, their churches, and their healthcare providers helping them out, and really see it as a partnership in terms of giving the information that they most need to give give their children. So I think people, despite I think fear around talking about issues of sexuality or just discomfort that can occur, people generally are relieved when people in leadership are willing to talk frankly about these issues and have correct information and have some skills to to dialogue about issues that can be controversial and can be sensitive, certainly.
So it sounds like the Our Whole Lives curriculum, which I had mentioned earlier, that's what that curriculum aims to do. So it's a comprehensive curriculum. It covers a lot of issues. It includes values, so it's not just information, but it's
exactly.
fact-based in the sense that it's based on good medical information versus somebody's hopes or wishes for what the
Absolutely.
Real world was like. So can you talk about how values and morality and faith fit into sexuality education, especially in a congregation where people might have very different views? Somebody might say, you know, my 18-year-old daughter, she's living at home. She's has a boyfriend, and I want to make sure she has birth control and is covered with that. Somebody else might say, I don't want my 18-year-old or my 16-year-old, I don't want her to have sex until she's married. And then so it's the parents, it's the young women and the young men themselves. How do you parse all that out when there's a range of beliefs and values and views?
Absolutely. I think most importantly, we try to provide a place where all those views can be discussed, or if not discussed, can really be considered thoughtfully. And so the program, despite because of its values of justice and inclusivity, of being responsible human beings, of sexual health and well-being, because of all of that, the program really seeks to honor and value where every youth or parent might be on a wide spectrum of belief. So as a pastor, I'm not sitting there when I'm teaching the program and say, you need to do this or do this. I'm providing some information and then some tools about how to make the best possible decisions for oneself. So it's not didactic in that mm-hmm. in that sense. It's really about giving information and giving skills and instilling these values of self-worth and moral agency and well-being and making and whether or not to abstain or engage mm-hmm. in sexual behavior and responsible sexual behavior, and to know what contraceptive choices are out there, to know the risks of STIs, and to be able to recognize when relationships are healthy and when relationships are unhealthy.
You raise a really important point, is when to have sex and when not, when to abstain. So sometimes I think people think that sexuality education implies active sexuality, but it really helps people make decisions. And sometimes it gives people, especially young people, skills in terms of how to say no as well.
Absolutely. And the curriculum is really attempts to be age appropriate and really honors the sexual development of a human being, and that begins at birth and goes to death, and that it's not just about sex; it's about
right.
a much bigger picture about sexuality and about what it means to be part of a community and to have friendships and to have relationships.
Well, as you say, we're not just a bunch of disembodied spirits wandering
right.
around.
Right.
We are physically embodied.
Exactly.
And you are bringing this program to your congregation. So how are you building support for it? And how are you, have you had to get people ready? Are people eager for it? What's that process?
Absolutely. We've been working for several years to roll out the program. The program is available from kindergarten through adulthood, and we're going to start offering it to our 7th and 8th graders this coming year. And what I really did was have a lot of conversations with parents and lay leadership in the congregation about whether or not the congregation was ready. We had an Our Whole Lives trainer come and meet with us one evening and invited parents to come. And I think it was an early summer evening, and we were surprised at how many parents of children of all ages showed up and were so eager to hear about this program and wanting support in this area. Several years ago, this particular congregation, initiated by members in the church, in the pews, decided to take a formal vote to become what we call an open and affirming congregation in the United Church of Christ. And that was really making a statement that, you know, whatever one's race, ethnicity, age, socioeconomic or marital status, ability or sexual orientation, or the way one might express their gender, that whoever you are, that you are welcome into the full life and ministry of the church. And so when that formal vote happened, I knew that one of the next steps here was really including an educational component for our youth, that we can print the statement on our bulletin each week, but we also need to put our faith into action and to live out the values of an inclusive welcome. And a program like Our Whole Lives really helps give young people the tools and the resources they need to understand why our values extend this inclusive welcome, and why these values help us make really good and the best decisions that we can for ourselves and our families.
It sounds very smart. It's education. It's like theological education, mm-hmm. where you can say, I believe this or that, but then you need grounding so you know why you believe what you believe. So there's some substance there in this difficult world, and it sounds like that's what you're doing.
Absolutely.
With sexuality education. So I can imagine that some parts of that education curriculum might be, you know, not controversial. And I can imagine, because it's a comprehensive education curriculum, it will include issues of reproductive justice and abortion, which
Absolutely.
Are trickier, and they are more difficult, and they are more problematic for people. So how do you tackle that?
Right. I try to really stress first these two parts, this providing information and education about the rights every human being has in regards to sexual health and well-being and reproductive rights. And I try very much to instill the value that faithful women, that religious women, religious men are making a variety of choices about birth control, about whether or not to terminate a pregnancy, and that those decisions, to just like it is just as a person can choose to abstain or engage in responsible sexual behavior, so too can a faithful and religious person choose to terminate a pregnancy or not, or to use birth control or not. And so really trying to instill a value I think non-judgment, or of an openness to understand that while two people at the table might have make different choices, is that those options are available, and those are rights that that people can choose.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. I want to shift a little bit, or continue along those lines of reproductive justice, and talk about the CAPS Faith and Reproductive Justice Leadership Institute, of which you are a part. You're one of our leaders and one of our participants this year. So as a leader in this institute, and as somebody who works on these issues, what feel like pressing issues to you when you look at reproductive justice and faith, you know, in the coming days, coming months? And what do you think needs to happen?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I am just increasingly concerned and have been for some time about what I really see as backlash and assaults on women's moral agency and decision-making ability. And I feel that some of these legislative attempts really seek to insert one particular doctrine or moral judgment and really excludes other sets of values. And that I experience it and see it as discrimination. And as I, you know, just said, plenty of women who identify as religious choose faithfully to use birth control or terminate a pregnancy. And I feel their voices get lost when their rights are threatened in legislative attempts. And, you know, we live in a diverse religious landscape as well as a diverse landscape of sexuality. And I really want to hear more than one voice in the public square. And I think, as you can probably tell, education is just so important to me. And so I feel that religious literacy, that is learning about the wide diversity of religious expression that we have across our communities and countries, as well as sexuality education and literacy, that it's just so key, so key. And that, you know, again, not everyone in the pews agrees, but I really do believe we can come to some common ground when it comes to supporting freedom to make the best possible decisions, but that we're also each responsible, you know, not only to ourselves but to our wider community.
You just raised a very important point, because normally the debate around reproductive justice or abortion is framed around religion, and that's in opposition, and then around women's health or women's rights, and that's in support of the issue. But you're talking about a religious liberty argument and a religious belief argument that, in fact, supports women's reproductive rights and health from contraception, including the decision whether to continue a pregnancy or not. And as the United Church of Christ has positions, has doctrine, that bumps into some other doctrines that may be in opposition. But as you say, in a pluralistic democracy, nobody gets to trump automatically somebody else and then legislate my doctrine rules. Everybody else has to follow this, because then what about your religious freedom?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so that's a very important point, because normally we don't, in the public mind, in the public debate, people don't always associate religion with reproductive rights. So those are some of the challenges. What gives you hope? What's exciting to you right now about the work you're doing on the ground or things you see in the larger sphere?
Sure. Well, you know, clergy, we are in the business of hope. There is a great deal, actually, that gives me hope as a minister. I get especially hopeful on a day-to-day basis when I see individuals able to build the support systems around them to make good decisions for themselves and their families. And so when I see people working in partnership with people around them, I get hopeful. I'm hopeful when I see people choosing compassion over greed, and when I see people working to really share power with others rather than exploit or abuse power as a means to control others. And I'm especially hopeful when men join their voices to the conversation about reproductive health and become progressive advocates with and for the women in their lives and for themselves, of course. I really believe that reproductive justice helps everyone. There are certainly many challenges, but I certainly stand on the side of hope and an understanding of sexuality and spirituality being about love.
Thank you so much. Your being part of our institute gives us hope. And thank you so much for the work that you're doing and for talking with us today.
Great. Thank you so much, Sally.
Take care.
You too. Bye.